Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Allie on the Run show. I'm your host, Allie Feller, and this is episode 31. On this episode, I'm talking to the incomparable, indomitable, ultra-inspiring Dan Nevins. Dan is a motivational speaker and yoga teacher who teaches Baptiste-style yoga classes all over the world. He speaks to crowds of thousands, from yoga in Bryant Park, where he's taught class to more than 1,400 yogis at a time, to Fortune 500 companies. Now, since this is a podcast, obviously, you can't see Dan right now. But if you could, you would probably immediately notice that Dan has no legs. He has prosthetics. He's an Iraq War veteran who lost not just one, but both of his legs while serving overseas. In this episode, Dan talks about his life before he joined the U.S. Army and the fact that he was a super competitive athlete and runner. And he shares the life-changing story about how he lost his legs and one of his friends in an explosion. He talks about the 36 surgeries he underwent after the explosion, his experience with post-traumatic stress disorder, and how yoga eventually saved his life. Dan's story is a remarkable one about the power of perseverance, so I will let him take it from here. All right, so I am here today with the wonderful, the inspiring, the very cool Dan Nevins. How are you?
I am amazing. How are you?
I'm good. So, Dan, you are coming to us from sunny Florida.
Yeah, Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida, which is right next door to TPC Sawgrass. So we have a big golf tournament going on right now. So, yeah, it's pretty epic. And pretty great place to be.
And you're a golf guy. I feel like I see pictures of you on the golf course all the time.
I play one on TV. No, yeah, I do. I love golf. I used to be pretty good. And then... But you have to actually practice a lot to keep that up. So now I'm just okay.
Good enough. So Dan and I met a couple years ago at Lion's Den Power Yoga. Dan mm-hmm. was a visiting guest instructor because he, of course, is a yoga instructor himself. And I was like blown away by this guy. You're about to hear why. And I got to give you credit. You are the first person to get my husband to take a yoga class.
Yeah, that's right. And he didn't do bad either. He was, he held his own.
I mean, he was lucky that he was in a crowd of like 1,500 people, so he could very easily just kind of hide in there. But Dan taught a class at the summer yoga series at Bryant Park in Manhattan, which if you haven't done it, check it out. It's on Tuesdays and Thursdays in New York City all summer long, and it's so cool. And Dan came, and how many people showed up to your class? It was
just under 1,500, like 1,400 and some change.
Casual. So you're obviously very shy. You're like totally not comfortable in front of large groups of people. And the reason that I wanted to have you here today, well, first let's give us a warm up, because that's what us runners do. Us runners start things with a warm up. Tell us who you are, where you're from, and what you do.
So my name is Dan Nevins, and we'll see, like, from is a tricky question because I'm from Baltimore, from the hood in Baltimore, but I live in sunny Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida now, and I am a professional speaker, and I teach yoga all over the world.
So because Dan is a professional speaker, I'm going to do the world a favor and speak as little as possible on this episode because he has a really inspiring story. Dan, why don't you tell us a little bit about, you do these speaking engagements all over the world. Mm-hmm. Do you want to just jump in and kind of tell us what you tell them? Tell us
sure,
your story.
Yeah. And I'll keep it real casual too, because, you know, usually when you're, as a professional speaker, you're on stage and it's a big show. And, you know, sometimes it's really refreshing for me to just talk and share. And I think that's what I can do. And, you know, it's funny that, like, I'm a yoga teacher, and people that know me know how absolutely weird that is for me to say. You know, I grew up in the ghetto in Baltimore, and, you know, it was, not the most charmed life growing up in Charm City. You know, my mom left when I was 13. My dad was a truck driver and gone a lot. And so we just kind of had to put things together. And yoga wasn't even a word that I think I even knew growing up. And then I joined the Army to fight in the Gulf War, the first one. In 1990, I enlisted in my senior year of high school. In 91, the Gulf War started, and still in high school. And then the Gulf War ended, and I'm still in high school. And then I just went in and did 8 years of active duty Army. I loved it. And what I loved most looking back is that I actually learned how to become a man in the Army, wearing the uniform. I learned values. I learned about duty, honor, integrity, loyalty, selfless service. I learned the things that most people learn from their parents. And but I learned that in a uniform. And it was sad for me to leave. I did 8 years active duty. I did 4 years in Germany, 4 years at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, which was the best place in the world to be a soldier. Fort Bragg, you know, I got to jump out of airplanes and shoot all sorts of different weapons and blow things up. And it was the worst place in the world, by the way, to be a single dude, because there's 18 dudes to every female in that part of the world in Fayetteville, North Carolina. So any single ladies listening to your podcast, just go to Fort Bragg. You know, there's plenty of dudes. You know, they look and they
what
look
better
really
reason?
Good too. Right? They look. They
what
look
better
amazing.
Reason to enlist?
Right? No, don't enlist. Just go visit. Just go pick you up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just go visit. Go find one or two, and yeah, then you'll be good. No, but you know, I got out in 1999 and joined the National Guard. You know, because I couldn't give up my uniform because it was a part of who I was. But I'll tell you, the California Army National Guard was nothing like the active duty Army. You know, I left Fort Bragg, which is sort of the tip of the spear. It is a 4-hour recall to anywhere in the world. It's, you know, the most professional soldiers in the Army, they're all at Fort Bragg. And then the California Army National Guard was quite a far stretch away from that. And, you know, I left to go back to school. I went to school full time at Sonoma State University in California, and I got a degree in business. My first job was a stockbroker. It was actually that first job when 9/11 happened. And I remember, you know, watching the news, and especially when it was first happening, you know, when you're not there, and you're just watching it all unfold on TV and you're listening to the commentators, just not knowing what was happening when the first plane hit, was it an accident, what was it? And then when the second plane hit, that's when I think the whole world knew what was going on. And then my boss looked over at me and he's like, oh my God, you're in the National Guard. Do you think you're gonna go to war? And I said, it took a minute. And I took a breath and I said, like, no way. Like, not these people, not the guys from the National Guard. We're not gonna have to go fight in a war. Because, you know, I was comparing it to Fort Bragg, and, you know, if I was there, I'd have been like, absolutely, we're gonna fight. We'd be like probably, you know, ramping up in that moment. But, you know, and I kind of never thought we'd get deployed, actually, because I was with, you know, quote unquote, these people, right? Like, not the people that I would have choose to be deployed with, but people that some of them had never spent a day on active duty in their life. And it was kind of a surreal experience when we finally did get called to go. It was 3 years later. It was the very end of 2003, beginning of 2004. And, you know, I was scared. I was scared of, you know, what this deployment was going to be like, because I was with a bunch of these National Guard guys who you know, hadn't spent very much time in a uniform other than their one weekend a month for however many years it was. And then I thought, well, we're not going to do anything dangerous. You know, like, we're not going to go into harm's way. We're not going to, you know, do anything like that. But turns out that's exactly what we did. We were assigned to a new unit that was created called Task Force Tacoma, where we were responsible for external security of a place called LSA Anaconda in Balad, Iraq. And, you know, we learned some really tough lessons early on, and we lost some people. And, you know, there's something funny. Funny is not the word, but there's something actually incredible about goals. And when the consequence of not meeting your goals is that your best friends die, it kind of tends to put a lot of things in perspective. And in that, you know, when those consequences are that severe, what I learned is that us as human beings, like, we have this amazing ability to rise to the challenge. Like, this this incredible, transformative, like something deep down, visceral, primal, that when the stakes are that high, that you can surprise yourself at the amount of transformation that can happen. I mean, it seemed like at a cellular level, because I watched this group of untrained, undisciplined National Guardsmen become one of the most elite, vigilant fighting forces I've ever had the privilege of serving with. And it was just incredible to watch that transformation. And we got really good at our jobs. I remember, like, for months, we had this ridiculous operational tempo, 2 to 3 to sometimes 5 missions in a day. And it's basically like be gone in the grind of combat and then come back and sleep. And then you're right back at it again. And this is this group of, like, weekend warriors, these National Guard soldiers, and, like, really getting it done at the highest levels. And the Battle of Fallujah started November 7th, 2004. And it was mostly a Marine effort in Fallujah. And I wasn't in Fallujah. I was in a place called, like I said, Balad. But the Marine effort in Fallujah, I remember it because they stole my medic, Sergeant Goutreau, who's, like, the coolest dude you'd ever know and one of the best medics on the planet, in my opinion. He could shoot, move, and communicate, patch us up all at the same time. Like, he was Doc. He was the guy. And they stole him from us to go be with the Marines because they needed, you know, all the help they can get. And they had a good choice in Sergeant G. And we got a new medic, a guy named Dan Smee, who was assigned to us. And he was a California Army National Guard guy with a, you know, blonde hair that was way too long and talked like a stoner. And I was like, oh my God, is this dude high right now?
What better person to have by your side when you're at war?
Oh God. Yeah, I left Sergeant G to this guy. And, you know, but we had a couple missions together. And then 2 days later, November 9th, we got intelligence that some of the insurgency was leaving Fallujah to come to our area of operations. So, like the most professional army in the world, we drew up a battle plan and we decided to meet the enemy where they were. And we practiced, we prepared, we rehearsed for every possible contingency. We were up late that night and we had a 0400 hour, so 4 o'clock in the morning, start time the next morning. And I remember I got up and did my pre-combat checks with my guys, gave them all their high fives and let them know that they were good to go to get into the truck. And then I get to my lead vehicle and I go to get my driver's, this guy named Smitty, and I go to high five Smitty to let him know, like, it's time to roll out. And when he turned around, it wasn't Smitty, it was my boss, the guy named Sergeant First Class Mike Onalini. And if you knew Mike, like, you'd know that he wasn't always the smartest person in the room, and he wasn't always the most charismatic person in the room or the most well-liked person in the room, but Mike was the hardest working person in the room every time. And I don't care what room and what state and what country, like, he was the guy. He was the first to get somewhere. He was the last to leave. He was the first to volunteer, and he would grind, but he wasn't supposed to be on this mission. Like, I was leading this mission. I was the number two in command of our platoon. So he was my platoon sergeant, my boss, and I was the first squad leader. So he was actually getting a hernia operation that day. Like, he had been fighting through a hernia for months, and we finally, like, made him go get it fixed. And the surgery was scheduled for November 10th, the day of this mission, but, you know, weeks before this intelligence came down. So Mike, being the hardworking person that he is, I'm like, what are you doing here? And he said, well, you know, I told Smitty he was sick, so I could come and drive you guys, at least be a part of this operation with you. So I remember that interaction vividly, and just look at determination on his face and just how he shows up for people was evident right there. So I high-fived him. We got in the truck. So I high-five Mike, and we got in the vehicle, and we left the main gates of LSA Anaconda at exactly 0400. So 4 o'clock in the morning, right on time. And I remember weaving through the barriers and the entry control point, hitting we took a right on a paved road called Route Dover. It's a well-traveled road, like, lots of traffic. And then we took an almost immediate left on this unpaved road, this silty powder-like dirt road en route to what was supposed to be our dismount site. And I remember it was pitch black outside. I mean, low-hanging cloud cover, so you couldn't see the moon or stars. It was eerily black. And then I remember how quiet it was. Like, I remember bouncing down this pitiful road and in silence and in blackout drive. So, you know, we're using all night vision operations, And it was like the only thing I could hear was the familiar 6.2 liter Cummins diesel engine in our Humvee as we just bounced carefully down this pitiful road in silence. And then my head was bowed in prayer like it was before every mission. And as we're going carefully down that road, just boom. I remember the silence was destroyed by the deafening blast that sent my 18,000 pound vehicle about 6 feet in the air in a ball of fire. And I remember being in that prayer, and when the explosion happened, I could basically feel and hear the truck disintegrate around my body. And when I opened my eyes, I realized that I was ejected from the vehicle, but my legs remained caught in the twisted and burning metal that used to be the floorboard and undercarriage of the truck. And I remember, you know, my legs are still attached, but I'm laying in the dirt, and my face felt hot. I had a sickening knot in my stomach. I could taste blood in my mouth. My ears were ringing. My vision was going, like, kind of fading in and out. And I could start to see a little better now because my truck was on fire. So some lingering fire from the blast, you know, was providing some more light. But there was this massive dust cloud that was descending. So I really, even though my vision was kind of like wonky, I still really couldn't see what was going on. And as the dust started to descend and starting to kind of figure out what's happening, I'm like, okay, I'm hurt. And I really didn't understand the extent of my injuries. I remember the dust settled. And then I looked to the driver's compartment of the vehicle. And then I noticed instantly that Sergeant First Class Mike Adelini had made the ultimate sacrifice. And, you know, it was evident. And I knew, like, seeing how bad he was, I knew that I was probably pretty bad too. So just started to check myself out. And like we're trained, I started with my helmet and it came apart in two pieces in my hand. And that wasn't a good start, but hey, yeah, I was still conscious and that's good. And, you know, then I realized that, like everything in the government, that military equipment was made by the lowest bidder. So, you know, it could have just been a defect. I don't know. So I started to like continue to check myself, and then looking back and through blurred eyes and watching my team move with tactical proficiency, securing the perimeter, doing everything they're supposed to do. And I knew it would be some time until a medic got to me. So I started to do more self-assessment. I'm checking my arms, my hips, and my legs are up and still in the vehicle. But when I reached up for my leg, that's when I felt it. I felt the unmistakable arterial blood spurt with every beat of my heart. And I knew that I was going to die. I started to make my peace with God. I was saying goodbye to my wife, my 10-year-old daughter. I was just giving up. And, you know, like for those of you listening and Ali, you too, like you've heard people say that when you're about to die, your life flashes before your eyes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't my experience. For me, it was more like a unfulfilled list, like watching a slideshow of things that I wouldn't do. Like it was always been like a planner. Like I have all these great things I want to do. I want to climb Kilimanjaro. I want to do this. I want to do that. And it was like these images were coming up and I was saying goodbye to them. And like even some things I didn't even like know I wanted. And the last one I remember, it kind of got me. I was laying there losing what seemed like all of my blood in this miserable place on the planet. And this thought went to my daughter, all grown up, dressed in white and walking down the aisle without her dad. And then I sat up and was like, Dan, I'm alive. I'm alive. I better do something to keep it that way. So I just reached my hand in the wound in my thigh, almost up to my wrist, and trying to find the artery and stop the bleeding. And I thought I was going to be like MacGyver and like pinch off the artery and like, oh, I got this. I'm going to go walk it off. No, it's not like that. And I just pressed in this wound and prayed that I can just put enough pressure on it to slow the bleeding down enough to give time for the medic to arrive. And just like wishing Sergeant G was there. And, it's like I blinked my eyes and there was Dan Smee standing over me with his blonde hair saying, like, you're going to be all right, Sergeant Evans. He was fucking lying through his teeth. I knew it, but it's like I blinked again and there was a tourniquet on my leg, and I blinked again and there was an IV in my arm, and I blinked again and my whole team was there putting themselves in harm's way to remove my legs from that vehicle that was still on fire. And, it's like I blinked again. I was on a stretcher and then in a helicopter. And then for my like half a minute ride back to the Combat Surgical Hospital, which is right next to the main gates of LSA Anaconda that I had just left maybe 10 minutes before. And I remember going into surgery and got my happy juice pushed in my IV that was already in me, and I was out. And then I remember waking up from surgery in this recovery room. Well, a recovery room is a stretch. It's a tent. So like this recovery area of the tent. And I woke up and there was a combat nurse's face right in mine. And I'll never forget her face. And I'll probably never know her name, but I also will never forget what she said to me. She said, "Sergeant Evans, you're a very lucky man. We managed to repair your femoral artery. We had to take your left leg below the knee. We managed to save your right one for now, but you'll probably lose that one too." And then right about the time I was about to have my own pity party, it's like I looked up against the wall of the tent and there was my whole team just waiting for me to wake up. And I kind of shrugged off the pity party, and we told jokes, told some really inappropriate stories as military guys do. We laughed. We talked about Mike, who I wear this bracelet every day for Mike. It's a black memorial bracelet. It just says his name and Task Force Tacoma, 10 November 2004, Balad, Iraq. It's a memorial bracelet. A lot of military members will wear them for their friends. And, you know, it's funny because I wear mine not really to memorialize Mike, even though I do. It's a reminder for me. It's a reminder for two things. It's a reminder to work hard, because Mike, like, nobody worked. Like, if I could work half as hard as Mike, my life would be awesome. Like, he was so, so diligent and committed in everything he did. And, but it reminds me to work hard, because, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about goals and the power of goals, but a goal without hard work behind it is just a wish, really, a dream. I mean, I don't even know. It's like, it's actually a waste of fucking time. To talk about goals and just not put the work in behind them. So it reminds me to work hard to accomplish my goals and like actually do the effort, like do the thing that I say I'm going to do and not just talk about it. And it reminds me to live in a way that not only that Mike would be proud of me for, but to live in a way that's intentional, to like have my life mean something to you know, because I should have not should have died, like a survivor's guilt sounding, like I shouldn't have lived. Like, the odds were insanely against me to live. I mean, my femoral artery was cut in half. I when I woke up from that surgery, I spent the next 7 days at Lonsdale Regional Medical Center, and every hallway, the wards were full of Marines, most of them 18 and 19 years old, most of them worse off than me. And, you know, I have like what looks like piano wire holding my thigh together on both sides. And, you know, I'm just like a mess. I have this three different bacteria running through my body and my tissue, bones and blood, three deadly bacteria. And it's just, you know, like the odds of me being here are so small, but like I get to have this life. So like it reminds me to choose like every day to do something that means something. Right, to not just like bounce around. And yeah, like I have my days where like I choose to rest or choose to not do anything, but it's a choice. It's not what I'm up to. Like, what I'm up to is trying to be a force on the planet to change things, to make the world better, to make my life better, my family's life better, like everyone's life better. And I didn't know in those early moments how I was going to do that. You know, after my 7 days in Lonsdale, I spent a year and a half, almost 2 years actually, at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, 30 some different surgeries, mostly in an attempt to save my right leg, which I ultimately lost. And I just remember just all the time in the hospital, like, you know, looking forward to going home and going back to work, and what was I going to do, and, you know, what was my life going to be like? You know, when I first got to Walter Reed, it was crazy, because I'd spent 7 days in Lonsdale. I got my welcome to Walter Reed surgery, which was the most painful experience of my life. I remember them, you know, when they, for those you don't know, like when you get hurt in combat, they cut your uniform off you and they burn it because usually it's full of blood. And you remember they're cutting it off of me. And I just remember like feeling this sense of like they were cutting like my manhood away. Like I became a man in that uniform. And now they're just cutting it off. And I was like in this hospital gown. And I was in the hospital gown for 7 days at Landstuhl. And then didn't wash my face, didn't brush my teeth. Like I had surgery every day. It was a nightmare. And then I get to Walter Reed and they take you off all your pain medicine for the flight home because they want you to be lucid to meet your surgical team. And then I finally get to Walter Reed. There's this like harrowing ordeal on the plane with no pain medicine. And then they're peeling my bandages off. And it literally felt like they were ripping the flesh from my bones. And it's just something I just, you know, I forget about until I start talking about it. And then I woke up the next morning on Ward 57 at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And I met my nurse, Erica. And she was awesome. She was the first person that I actually got to talk to, like more than answering a pain scale question. And, you know, Erica was like absolutely, her bedside manner was perfect. And she was so hot. She was gorgeous. She was so hot. I think I proposed to her like 15 times and I was married at the time. I was like, I didn't care. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to marry you. But you know, I say she's so hot. She was very attractive, but the fact that she had pain medicine made her a 10. She went from like, she had pain medicine. She was like an angel. And, I love her so much. And, yeah, she was awesome. And just like just one day of getting to know her, one day of just finally being able to talk to another human being was just paramount for like my well-being. And I remember when she came in and she brought lunch and she said, hey, we have some really good news. Your wife is on her way here from California. She should be here around 3:00. And I remember like that was supposed to be good news, but it wasn't. You know, I didn't want to see her. You know, I had left a year earlier physically fit, kind of top of my game, and now here I was broken and useless, like laying in a hospital bed. Like one leg is gone. The other one, they said it's probably going to go, which ultimately did. And, you know, what can a guy with no legs do? Like nothing. You know, I looked at my wife and I, like we met, like we were both competitive runners. And like running is what brought us together. And that was our thing. That's what we did. And now that was going to be gone forever. Like, I don't have legs. I can't run. You know, how would she see me? Like, I didn't think she'd even love me anymore. Like, what's there left to love? Like, all the things that we were, gone. All the things that I was, gone. And yeah, I didn't want her to be there. And it's not really that I didn't want to see her. I didn't want her to see me. Not like that. And I remember just dreading that, and I had a couple bites of lunch, and then Erica came back in my room. She said, hey, there's some people here that I think you should see. And I was like, yeah, okay, because she was like the only human being that I trusted at that point. And then in comes two of the founders of Wounded Warrior Project. And I've never heard of Wounded Warrior Project before then, but they came in with this backpack full of like comfort items. And on the outside of the backpack was this logo that I instantly related to. It was one warrior carrying another off the battlefield, the fireman's carry, and then the words Wounded Warrior Project. And I was like, wow, that's me. I'm a wounded warrior. And I just a week ago, I was the guy on the top of that logo being carried off the battlefield. And, you know, if I had this backpack, like if everyone was able to see it right now, everyone would take for granted what's inside. It was shorts and a T-shirt. Something I could put on though to feel human again, because like being in a hospital gown for over a week and, you know, it's not the most flattering piece of attire in the world. A little drafty in the back, you know. And then you know, it was, you know, a calling card to call home. If you guys remember calling cards before, when long distance used to cost things, right? We'd had those, and there was, you know, there were toiletries, toothbrush, toothpaste. And I was about to see my wife for the first time in almost a year. And after a week of not brushing my teeth, that was pretty important. You know, there were socks in there. I didn't really need those so much, but they were there, right? In case I could find a use for some socks. There a deck of playing cards, CD players, CDs, and a bunch of notes and cards from grateful Americans saying thank you for your service and your sacrifice. It's probably the most significant gift I've ever received, and it will probably remain the most significant gift I'll ever receive. And that was just my introduction to that organization that was an integral part of my recovery at Walter Reed. I mean, everything from snowboarding, wakeboarding, rock climbing, outrigger canoeing, kayaking, kiteboarding. Wounded Warrior Project was at my bedside making me take opportunities to prove that my disability didn't define me, that I get to define what the rest of my life was going to be like.
And weren't you not into it at first? The first time they came by, weren't you like, what is this? Or you were like, not sure, not ready?
Oh, yeah. No, it was this. So they came into my room the first time they came in my room and they said, so I'm flat on my back. Like one leg's in traction. The other leg's gone. I got like what looks like piano wire holding my leg together. My doctors are telling me how like I'm like barely surviving from all this bacteria that's in my body. And I have to have surgery after surgery. Like I'm gaunt. Like it's like my second week in the hospital. My wife's there now. And she's like, she still loves me allegedly. Like we're divorced now. So the jury's out on that one. But you know, like, so like my wife's there and I'm just like, I look like death barely warmed up. Like, it's just horrible. And they come bebopping, strolling to my room like, hey, Dan, we're taking a bunch of Wounded Warriors out west to go skiing next month. We want you to go. And I looked at these people like, I'm going to choke the shit out of you. Like, no, I'm not. Like, I just, if they were closer, I probably would have grabbed them by the neck. And then I could tell that they could see how frustrated I was because I wasn't saying anything bad. I was just like, oh, okay. But in my head, I was like wishing them all sorts of horrendous death. And but they saw right through it. And they said, listen, Dan, like, I don't think you get it. Like, we have the best adaptive equipment in the world and the best adaptive instructors in the world. And if the hospital clears you to go, we'll get you to the bottom of the mountain. And that moment is when I started to realize that, look, hey, it might not be as bad as I think. And really, if that's all Wounded Warrior Project ever did for me, I'd still say what a great organization they are. But then they put their money where their mouth is. And I couldn't get medically cleared for that original trip that they were talking about, but it had nothing to do with my physical wounds. It had everything to do with the bacteria. I had 3, Pseudomonas, Acinetobacter, and MRSA in my blood, tissue, and bones. And I was on this crazy antibiotic treatment protocols, and yeah, I couldn't go. But after that, it was, again, snowboarding, rock climbing, outrigger canoeing, kayak. I mean, you name it. They were making me take these opportunities to prove that my life could be whatever it is I wanted it to be. And after my 2 years in the hospital, that relationship continued. And I got out, you know, I retired from the military, and I went back to work in pharmaceutical sales. Which that was my job after a stockbroker. I went into pharmaceutical sales and had this great job. You know, bought a house in Northern California, lived on a vineyard. Like, my backyard was a vineyard as far as you could see. It was like, you know, like I was this poor kid from Baltimore. I was living the American dream. And then when I went home to back to that life, it was empty. It just didn't fulfill me at all. And then my wife's mom was dying in Florida, so we packed up everything and moved to Florida. And then I quit my job in pharmaceutical sales because I wanted to go into veteran service. So I tried to get a job at Wounded Warrior Project, and they wouldn't hire me at first because they were a small organization, and they really didn't have any money to hire people. So I went to work for the PGA Tour and got to stand up all their military appreciation programs around the country, and that was awesome. And then after a few years of doing that, Wounded Warrior Project asked me to come over, and then I did. And I spent 7 years working at Wounded Warrior Project, helping grow that organization from a $10 million organization to an almost $400 million organization. From serving like just the severely injured people at Walter Reed, that was the original, you know, like where they started, to serving a generation, a whole generation of wounded warriors and their families, over 100,000 warriors and their families through a myriad of programs every day now. Like, wow. That organization is changing lives, I mean, on a global scale. And I got to be a part of that. And in that time, like, I learned a lot of statistics. And basically in 10 years of veteran service, I learned that 400,000 service members live with the invisible wounds of war, PTSD. And I didn't really identify with that because I didn't suffer from PTSD. Like, I lived with combat stress and I had some of the symptoms, but like, PTSD is a diagnosis. So a doctor has to tell you you have it. And I avoided those doctors, so I never got that diagnosis. but yeah, was I living with the symptoms? Yeah, sure. But what I learned working at Wounded Warrior Project was a lot of great ways to cope. and all of them were physical, whether it was running again, which I never really restirred my affinity for because I used to be like sub 5 minute miler. And then now I can, like, my fastest mile after that was like 7:30. And I was just like, that's horrible. And like, I can't do this. Cause I don't want to go backwards. So it's a lot of looking for new things to do. And when, I know this is a running podcast. So when I say sub five, I mean like 4:55.
That counts.
Not like four, right? Yeah.
That's
pretty
good.
I could break 10 minutes for 2 miles and then past that. No, they start to get stretched out.
Well, so go back in time. So tell me, because we went from the hospital to the Wounded Warrior Project stuff. Right. At what point were they like, hey, you have to lose your second leg?
That was my choice, actually.
Oh, it was?
So I retired in 2006 and I still had a right leg, but I was on a ridiculous amount of pain medicine. I mean, enough to like no shit kill an elephant. And you know, but I had to because my right ankle was like this incredible source of pain. But when I first went through, the doctors gave me the option to save it. So I was like, well, yeah, if you're gonna give me the option, yeah, we'll save it. And then 3 years later, so it was January of 2008 actually that I got it taken off. And it was, so November 2007, I realized I got another bone infection in my ankle. And then that was like the straw that broke the camel's back. I'm like, I'm not doing this anymore. So I called my surgeons at Walter Reed and said, hey, we're taking my leg off. And then they said, like, you know, okay, we'll schedule the surgery. And I went up. And then when I got there, they tried to like say, well, we could do this. We could fuse it. We could do that. And I literally shushed my surgeon. I put my finger on his mouth and just like, not on my mouth, on his. And I shushed him. And I was like, tomorrow morning, 6 a.m., you're chopping my fucking leg off. And they were like, all right. And then they did. Best decision ever made medically. And so then I became a double amputee. And 8 weeks after that, because I couldn't run at all with my right leg. So it was 8 weeks after that that I started running again.
So which was harder? Was it coming back after the first leg and kind of learning to walk again? Or was it after both? What's that like? Because I cannot imagine at all what that is like.
The first one was way harder because I had one prosthetic leg and then my other leg was like a Frankenstein science project. They had to take part of my calf to put down by my ankle and my leg was just swollen and gross and my toes were, the reality is they should have just taken it off right there. They shouldn't have even given me a choice. But when they give you the choice, like you kind of, I would imagine everybody would be the same as me. Like, well, let's give it a shot. Let's try to save it. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did though, too, because now that it's gone, like I know for sure the right choice was to save it. I mean, was to take it off. But if I would have taken it off early on, then say I had a bad day or something hurt, I'd be like, man, I wonder what it would have been like if I would have saved it. You know, it had that like possibility of regret. And so now I don't. So like I'm clear and my life is amazing. And since then I've climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. I became a single digit handicap in golf. Like I got to do like all these things. And those were all my coping tools, like from the invisible wounds of war. Like I got to go hike or go on a run or ride an unadapted road bike thousands of miles all over the country. By working with the Wounded Warrior Project, I did these things called soldier rides. So I'd ride through New York City and D.C. and in Germany and all over the world riding a bike, you know, with no legs. Like, and you know, that's inspirational for some people. But the reality is for me is that like served my ego because like, I can play golf and beat people with legs, or I can ride my bike faster than people with legs, or I can, you know, like it just served my ego, which I mean, a little bit of ego is good, but you know, it kind of got on the other side of good in some situations. And that's what I did to not have to address the invisible wounds of war was to go kick ass in some sort of physical activity. And it was like that for years, but until like, a little over 3 years ago, I had to have another surgery. It was surgery number 36, like no big deal. Like, yeah, no big deal. So like my right leg, because of all that work I had done to save it, there's a lot of scars on it, which became part of like the residual limb, like what's left below my knee. And those scars became invaginated and gross and like got to this precancerous, you know, condition. So the doctor's like, we got to cut some of that out. And I was like, you know, okay. But the difference was with this one is I went to Walter Reed with the best surgeons in the world, but then I came home to be alone, to heal. And I had my oldest daughter, who is now in her late teens, had joined the Army, and I was not married, and I had a three-year-old daughter that I shared with my ex-wife, and I couldn't even, like, watch her. I couldn't even have my time with her because I could barely get around. I'm on one prosthetic leg and crutches. It's kind of really hard to chase a three-year-old around. I couldn't lead my team at Wounded Warrior Project. I couldn't play golf. I couldn't ride a bike. I couldn't go for a run. I couldn't go for a hike. I had to sit and fester in my invisible wounds, and then I had nothing to do to cope with them, and then shit started to fall apart. And you know, in my time, I learned a lot of statistics, like the 400,000 with PTSD, and I learned about 320,000 that live with a traumatic brain injury, and I was one of those. And I live with a traumatic brain injury right now, and it's much better than it used to be. But, and well, now the good news is, like, I have a built-in excuse for forgetting things, but but that's really all it is. It's an excuse, because it's much better now. But the statistic I never understood was from a 2010 VA study, that 22 veterans a day take their own life. And I never got it. I never understood it. I had, like, rejected that for years. And they're weak, or that study can't be right. And until one, I started to lose some of my friends. And then me being home alone for those 8 weeks, like, healing, I actually started to understand how it happened. And I wasn't suicidal. But if I had to spend a year like that, I probably would be one of those 22. Because, like, I had nothing to do with to cope. So I couldn't sleep. And when I did fall asleep, finally, I'd have nightmares to wake up. And I'd have to, you know, take a handful of Benadryl and chase it down with some whiskey just to fall asleep at night. And then, like, really not wanting to wake up in the morning. And then I did, and it was, like, the same thing all over again. And I knew I needed help. And I really... I wanted to call Wounded Warrior Project, but then I knew, because I knew they'd, I don't know, but I thought they'd probably take it a little too seriously and, like, send the SWAT team in to kick down my door and, like, rescue me and take me up to some treatment center somewhere. And I didn't want that. So I called a friend of mine, and then she said the dumbest thing that any human being has ever said to me. She said, I told her what was going on. And then she said, Dan, you need some yoga in your life. And I was like, I will slap the taste out of your mouth. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And and I actually was saying that to her, not in my head. Like,
such
I was
a sweetheart.
Saying how ridiculous she was. And plus, because I'm not in a good, like, I'm not in the best frame of mind at this time in my life either. And she heard me, and she said, well, what about meditation? And I had read meditation books before, seen it in business journals, and I was like, you know, like, Gandhi seems cool. Like, okay, I'll try some meditation. And I had tried it before with, like, no success, but she came and taught me about how meditation is actually being present, not, like, trying to empty everything and go to some other plane of existence, which is what I always thought it was. And so she showed me some really great techniques, and then I started to meditate. And after a couple weeks of that, I started to see, like, improvements in my life. Like, the negative thoughts got fewer and fewer, and then the quality of the rest of my thoughts got better, and I was able to go to sleep at night and not wake up with nightmares. And I was like, oh, this is actually really great. And then after the end of my rehab, I had a pretty solid meditation practice, although very new meditation practice. It had been a few weeks, maybe almost a month, and I got my leg back, and I could, you know, start to put some weight on it and get ready to go back to work. And I called my friend Anna, and I, you know, said thank you. And then she said, oh, this hippie yoga meditation stuff worked for you, huh? Like, kind of giving me, like, the raking me over the coals a little bit. And I deserved every bit of it. And I said, yeah, it did, actually. And she's like, well, I think you owe me some yoga. And I was like, oh, man, I can't get out of it now. So I agreed to 3 private lessons. And I remember, you know, I'm going to do these 3 lessons, and I got it. So I got to play I'm an all or nothing guy. So I'm like, well, I got to go to Lululemon, get an outfit. So I went to Lululemon, and I was like, my man card just leaped out of my wallet and started ripping itself up. And, I think, you know, I bought a pair of shorts and a shirt for like, I think like $3 or $4 million I'm going to pay for this yoga outfit. And I'm just, now I'm just even more mad about how expensive this thing is. And I don't even know if I'm going to do it or not. I went and bought a, you know, $120 yoga mat. And then like, so I show up to a yoga studio. Now I'm like just scraps left of my man card. Like I'm in a yoga studio with a yoga mat wearing Lululemon clothes. I'm like, oh God, like this is ridiculous. And then I go to my first lesson and she starts to teach me yoga. And she told me about Tadasana. It's the root of all asanas. And, you know, and I was kind of barely paying attention, but all I remember is that it sucked. Like I'm wearing these prosthetic legs and she's telling me these stupid things like root down to rise up. And I'm like, what the hell does that even mean? Root down. I don't even have feet. And I'm like literally like cursing at her, like throwing my block across the room. I'm like, this is so dumb. And like, she's like, do this warrior pose. And I'm like, this is, I'm a warrior. I've never done a pose like this in my life. You know how I get shot doing this? This is like, you know, like I'm just like, this isn't right. And I'm having all this pain and I'm wobbly on my prosthetics and just miserable. So we go through the hour and I'm like done. I am like, I'm never doing this yoga bullshit again. And, you know, I leave. And then she calls me later that night to schedule the second appointment. And I was like about to just tell her where to go, put her, you know, head. Right. And, but then I realized that I had committed to 3 lessons. And so I just swallowed that giant lump of pride in my throat and signed up for the second lesson. We chose a date. And I remember being at my second lesson and it's the same shit all over again. Root down to rise up and I can't feel anything and my leg is still actually hurting from where the surgery was and I'm wobbly and I'm sweating and it's I can't do these things. Like I can't physically do the poses and I like my man card is gone now because one, it's yoga. How hard can it be? And I can't do it. Are you kidding me right now? Like I was just so mad and so frustrated, I looked at her and I said, can I just try this with my legs off? And she kind of looked at me, and she was a newer yoga teacher, and she was like, yeah, sure. And I know in her head, she was like, what am I going to do with this guy with no legs? Where am I going to tell him to put his feet? Like, holy shit, I could see it. But she was a yes. Like, she said, yes, like, let's do it. And I remember taking my legs off, which is, it's important to note that, like, nobody got to see me with my legs off. Nobody. Because I was a runner. It was the best part of my body. They looked good. Like they were my legs. They were powerful and strong. And like, you know, I always wore shorts, even in the wintertime. My legs were tan and like I had decent feet. Like, you know, like I was just like, then when they were gone, like I had to deal with that whole thing. But I had an incredible amount of shame when what used to be these strong, powerful legs transformed into like these weak looking, shriveled up, atrophied, scarred up, like remnants of legs. And, but then I got prosthetics and that got to go over what was left. And then that was cool. And like kids always thought I was half robot, which was cool. And, you know, and kids stare, which is great and doesn't bother me at all, but like they always do. And then I always say something like, cool, huh? And they're like, oh yeah, what happened? And they're always with their mom or dad or something. And then you go, well, I didn't eat my vegetables as a kid.
Dan!
Yeah, I know. And then their mom's like, yes. And you know, I let them off the hook, but I did do that. And then, but nobody got to see what was under there. Like nobody. Like Anna might have been like the 5th or 6th person in 10 years to see my legs, my actual legs. I remember getting on my mat and like, I'm gonna figure out this Warrior One pose. I'm gonna do Warrior One. And I remember her, what she was saying and like how to do it basically, but now I'm gonna do it on my knees. And I'm on my mat and I'm about to get into position. And I remember what she said. She said, root down to rise up. And I'm gonna preface this with saying that this, like I eat meat and I shoot guns and I'm very much a dude. And although I care about what I put in my body and, you know, like, and I'm a little more connected than I used to be. But at that time in my life, like I was the least hippie granola tree hugging, like none of that stuff fit me at all. Like I was very much just a dude and like what is this crap in yoga? And, but here I am, I'm on this, my mat. And I said to myself, okay, root down to rise up. What does that mean? So I imagined roots from like a tree growing out of my body into the earth. And I spread my legs apart and I like remember feeling so connected at that point. And when I reached my arms up, it was like the earth sent a for real jolt of energy into my body, like being hit by lightning from the ground into my body. And it was like my arms flew up over my head. Like if I were to make a movie of it, light would be shooting out of my hands and tears are streaming out of my face because I didn't know what was happening. I had this breakthrough moment of my life on a fucking yoga mat in a yoga room. Like, and I'm like, holy shit. And poor Anna's behind me, just probably sitting wondering what she's going to tell me to do with my feet. Like, and I'm just like, oh my God. Like it was like the earth was saying, Dan, where have you been for the last 10 years? And I realized, like, now looking back, it's like I just wasn't connected at all, like floating above the earth in these prosthetics, like not taking a minute to realize where I was in the world and the planet with my family, with my friends. And that lack of connection to the planet, to the earth, like kept me from connection everywhere in my life. And then it's like it all came rushing back in like a moment. And I was just a mess with like tears and snot. And at the same time, I couldn't have been more happy. It was like an absolute most incredible, phenomenal experience of my life. And then I spent the rest of that lesson learning how to modify more poses. And then my next private lesson, like I think it was 2 days later, I was signed up for yoga teacher training. Then I remember graduating yoga teacher training, not wanting to be a yoga teacher. Like I didn't want to teach yoga, that was dumb. And I just wanted to learn more and I wanted more warriors to practice yoga and I wanted to be the catalyst that like invited them to yoga, like come to yoga, but like I don't want to teach it. And that's how it was for months. Like I just wanted to practice yoga and like military people, like the way they show love to each other is by making fun of each other. Like, you know, you give each other a hard time when you care about them. And I must have a lot of friends that care about me because I got the hardest time in the world for having a yoga picture on my Facebook page. Oh my God. It was like just constant ribbing and reaming from people for months and months and months. But like, I'm trying to like get people to go to yoga and I'm not having very many takers or like really any at all. And then it was, I think like, so February, March, April, May, June, July, August, it's like 6 months later. And I was at a golf event right at TPC Sawgrass, which is right across the street from my house. And there were like 30 wounded warriors there. And I ran into one of my buddies and he actually said, Dan, you look different, like lighter, healthier. He's like, is that the yoga? Cause it's not yoga, it's the yoga if you're a dude. Is that the yoga? And I said, yeah, it is actually. He's like, man, I want to learn more about you. You tell me more about it. And I got so excited. I'm like, yeah, let's come to my house for a beer after golf. Cause my house is right around the corner. I'm like, just follow me after. And like, he said like, yeah. So I'm like, holy shit. I'm so excited because like, I get to actually tell a dude that wants to hear about yoga and an army dude. Like, this is awesome. And I remember as he's following me to my house, I'm getting nervous. Like a dad that's about to have the sex talk with his kid. And like, how am I going to bring it up? Like, what are we going to do? Should we sit on the couch? Should like, we be in different couches? Like, what is it? How, what's the dynamic going to be? So we get to my house and we're having a beer and thankfully he brings it up. He's like, oh, so what's up with the yoga? And I get so excited. I'm pulling out all these books that I have. Like my teacher, a guy named Baron Baptiste has a book called Being a Power. I can bring that out. A book called The Four Agreements, which people who are listening, you should read both of those books. And, you know, I'm showing them all these things that have been really helpful to me. And I happen to look up and I'm like excited like a puppy telling him all this stuff. And then I see his face and I could tell that something's wrong. And I look at him and I say, hey man, is everything okay? And then he looked at me and said, no. And everything's not okay. And his eyes were filling up with tears. And, he kept talking. He said, 2 days ago, my wife found me in my closet with a gun in my mouth. And I was a second away from pulling the trigger when she opened the door and my little girl was there. And he looked at me and said, "Dan, I just don't know what to do." And then the only thing that would come out of my mouth was, "You need some yoga in your life." And then, much to my surprise, he just looked at me and said, "Teach me." And I was like, holy shit, I didn't pay attention in teacher training. I'm like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to actually teach yoga, but I tried. I wound up teaching my first class to one dude in my living room. And it was the worst class that's ever been led. But at the end of it, I knew where he lived, and I knew another teacher who owned a yoga studio where he lived. And I called her and I paid for his first month of unlimited yoga and got him a yoga mat and just said, "Hey, show up." So he was showing up to yoga. And I didn't tell her what was going on with him, but I asked her to keep an eye on him, and she did. She told me when he was coming and not. And 3 weeks later, I get a call, and it's him. And he's like, "Hey, man, I just want to call to say thank you." He's like, "My month's about to expire. I wanted to call to say thank you and tell you that I'm going to renew." And the way that he was saying it, it sounded like he was thanking me for paying for it. And so I said, "Man, don't worry about it. I know the owner. She gave me a really good deal," which she didn't, by the way. But, you know, I was saying that to him. And then he said, "Dude, I'm not thanking you for paying for my yoga." He said, "I'm thanking you for saving my life." And I didn't really get it, but he kept talking and he said, "Yesterday was a really bad day. And I went to go get my gun, but I grabbed my yoga mat instead." And then I was just blown away. And then we talked a little more, finished up the conversation. I hung up the phone and then I signed up for my level 2 yoga teacher training. And this time I paid attention. And then ever since, I've been a fucking yoga teacher, and it's still the weirdest thing in the world to say, but it's also the most important work that I've ever done. And I'm a dad, and I've led soldiers in combat, and I was an executive at a nonprofit that's changing the face of veteran service in the country. And I've done a lot of really cool things in my life, and by far, teaching yoga is the most important work I've ever done.
So what do you tell the people who are listening who have not tried yoga because they don't think they're good at it, they don't think it's cool, they don't have any Lululemon? What, in addition to everything you just said that I hope sold a lot of people on it unintentionally, what do you tell them?
I'd say that, look, like, it's the most ancient form of exercise, and it endured for a reason. So, like, there's that. And everyone's bad at yoga. Until they do it. So that's why it's called a practice, not a perfect. And I'd say this is that you don't know until you know. And there's only one way to find out. And it's the hardest exercise I've ever done. And I've done CrossFit and I was a runner and all these things. And it's great because it helps with the connection of mind and body, like connecting. It's meditation in motion. It's definitely worth trying it. And if you do go, I want to remember this. And when you do start to have like great benefits from it and you're starting to see a change in your life, because I promise you that's what will happen, is I want you to invite a veteran to yoga because you might just save their life.
Dan, I never know what to say. I've heard you tell this story 4 times now, and I always get to the end and I feel like I want to say something like thank you or that's amazing, and I always just kind of sit here like really dumb, like I'm just going to bask in it now. So I'm guessing I'm not the only one feeling that way right now, but thank you for sharing your story. It's just amazing. It's amazing that you came back and then had more setbacks and found your way through all that. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the power of not stopping, right? Like, life takes us out at every corner. Like, there's always something waiting to take us out. And it will only, like, no matter what it is, illness, disease, relationships, whatever, it will only take you out if you let it. And that's the important distinction to make. And the more I practice yoga, the more I actually embody that. And, you know, because it's easy to say, it's very true. Like, we let things take us out. That's 100% true. But when you're being taken out by life, it's very easy to get taken out by life. But the more time I spend on my yoga mat, the easier it is for me to recognize that and just get right back in.
And when you practice now, do you practice without your prosthetics on?
Yeah, take my legs off.
But you teach with them on.
I teach with them on, right? Because I have to walk around the room and like I can demo poses and things like that and assist and, you know, and touch people and assist them into greatness in their poses. But if I'm going to really practice, I mean, I can practice with my legs on. It's just not, it's just a little foreign because for me, it's only with my legs off. And now I have no shame. I'm like, no shame in what's left of my legs. Those are mine. They're the only legs I'll ever have again. I mean, this is it. It's my body and I love it.
Well, you're killing it. So normally on this show, we end with a lightning round. I feel like that's a rough transition, right, from like all the heaviness. But how do you feel about lightning rounds?
I'm down with lightning round. We
all
can
right.
do it.
All right, let's do it. Let's wrap this up nice and light. So Dan Nevins, are you ready? We call this the sprint to the finish line, which like I feel like is BS because you're like still faster than me. I'm like going to be a little bitter about that for a little while.
Oh, no, you're okay. Well, actually now I don't even know what my mile time would be and I'm sure it's horrendous.
Probably not. But okay, so here we go. We're sprinting to the finish line. Dan Nevins, what would your last meal on earth be?
Oh, a medium rare to rare. Probably, if it's my last meal, probably a ribeye with blue cheese smothered all over it with like some Brussels sprouts cooked in like bacon and fatness and potatoes, like whipped old style country potatoes with butter and pepper and yeah, with still just enough chunks in it, but like not a lot, maybe a little dash of horseradish in it. Yeah.
Okay. I like the specificity of that meal. That's really good. And now I'm craving it.
And a really amazing, like first growth Cabernet, like a Latour, like an 82 Latour, just the whole bottle just for me.
Just the whole bottle. I mean, yeah, I may as well. What is your favorite movie?
Oh God. So many. That's such a tough one. We're going to go. I Shawshank Redemption wants to come out of my mouth, but that's actually not it. This is supposed to be a lightning round.
Yeah, this is supposed to be a sprint to the finish. You're right. You have slowed down.
Got it. Sprint to the finish. Got it. All right. Shawshank Redemption. Go.
Okay. Greatest fear.
Not finding true love and happiness.
Aw. How would you describe yourself in three words?
Optimistic, resilient, and fun.
Yeah, those are good ones. What's the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning?
Put my legs on.
Last thing you do before you close your eyes at night?
Take my legs off.
What is your favorite yoga pose?
Ooh, Shavasana.
Oh yeah, same. That's a good one. I thought you were going to say warrior pose.
Anybody else who says anything different than Shavasana is lying.
Yeah, agreed. What is your go-to breakfast?
Ooh, eggs and bacon on toast with cheddar cheese. Melted.
Nice. Where's your happy place?
Ooh, teaching yoga anywhere.
Where is somewhere you're dying to travel?
Australia.
Favorite thing to do after a really tough yoga class?
Drink a beer.
Who was your childhood celebrity crush?
Courtney Cox. Well, ooh. Like that's not childhood. That was like adulthood. So like childhood was Daisy Duke. Catherine Bach was her name.
Mm-hmm. All right. This is the last question. This is like a big one. You're hosting a dinner party and you get to have five guests. They can be anyone. Who are they?
Jesus.
Okay.
Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, and Alec Baldwin.
Okay, so he's gonna like lighten things up. I was like, this is gonna be right. A pretty heavy dinner party,
right,
man.
Exactly.
I like that. And what's on the menu? The Brussels sprouts, the steak,
Brussels sprouts,
the whole deal.
The steak, and like I gotta have some vegetarian food.
Yeah.
And then some like I would as a host, I would make sure everyone was accommodated for what they like.
Oh, that's right. I mean, you can hire a caterer. Like it's your dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
Party,
yeah,
and
they
unlimited
would be
budget. Successful.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Dan, you made it to the finish. I could hear you tell your life story every day. I feel like maybe I just need to listen to this episode now every morning that I wake up and I'm like, I'm in a bad mood. I'm going to be lazy today because I could probably use that kick in the butt a little more often. And tell people, where can they find you on the internet? Where can they take your class? Where can people get a little Dan Nevins in their life?
All right, so I would go to dannevins.com, D-A-N-N-E-V-I-N-S. My schedule's on there and all the things that you need to know and the contact button, which is way better than email, but there's also Dan Nevins at Facebook and Dan Nevins on Instagram and Dan Nevins on Twitter. and all those things.
Very consistent. And you will be in New York City coming up.
June 3rd at Lion's Den, teaching a fundraising class for Wounded Warrior Project. It's a 2-hour masterclass, so there will be lots of sweat and laughter and maybe some tears and some soreness to follow the next day.
All right, so check that out, people. I'm super sad to miss it. I'm seeing Celine Dion in concert that day in Las Vegas.
Okay. So. You get it. You get an excused absence.
Fine, but as a fan of Dan Evans, as someone who's taken his class, it'll change your life. So hit it up. And Dan, thank you so much for doing this.
Of course. Thank you, Allie.
So that's Dan Evans. Pretty amazing story, right? Every time I'm feeling a little down, a little bummed, a little sick, whatever excuse I'm turning to on any given day, I try to remember Dan and what he's been through and the way that he is now. He just has this amazing positive attitude, and he's been through a lot. He's been through more than I think I will ever experience in my lifetime, or that I hope to experience in my lifetime. And I'm in such awe of his perseverance and all of the amazing things he does every day. So Dan, thank you so much for being on the show, and to everyone who is listening, thank you so much for joining us and for being a part of the Allie on the Run Show community. I'm loving it here. I say that every week. I know I'm super annoying, but I do. I'm really enjoying doing this and getting to share people's stories. And Dan is one of those stories that I've now heard 4 times and still can't get enough and still need that reminder to do my best every day and try to put my excuses aside. So thank you for being here. I hope you're having a great day. Enjoy Memorial Day weekend. Remember what it is all about. If you can, remember Dan is teaching at Lion's Den Power Yoga next weekend. So go to lionsdenpoweryoga.com, sign up for his class. It'll change your life. Until then, have a great day. Have a restful weekend. And thank you for joining me on the run.